apologize to anyone who was inconvenienced by the delay in our starting time. Our floor session ran late today. I think most of y'all are here, or many of you are here, to participate in the discussion on Senate Bill 1011. So we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1011. And we will start with Council's summary.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 1011 would provide a specific statute of limitations for causes of action based on injury or death resulting from COX-2 inhibitors. Under this measure, a civil action related to the use of a COX-2 inhibitor will be permitted to commence within 2 years after the plaintiff first discovered or should have discovered the injury and the relationship between the injury and the product. In the case of a cause of action for death from the use of a COX-2 inhibitor, the statute of limitations would be no later than 3 years from the date of the causal relationship, of the discovery of the causal relationship between the death and the product.
Thank you very much. We will start out with a panel, and the next witness after the panel will be Teresa Teeter, who indicated that she came from more than 100 miles away. And so the first panel will be Brad Higbee, John Moulton, Mike and Tony Yackert, and Jamie and Cal Larrany. And we're a little short on chairs, so maybe, Mr. Higbee, I'll let you organize how people come up. We can get you more chairs if you need them.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. If you don't mind, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Higbee, I'm in support of Senate Bill 1011. I might kick off with a few introductory remarks and then help to bring people up, members of the panel that you just mentioned, if that's all right with you. Mm-hmm. And I will try to be brief here. And speaking of brief, hopefully you have already available to you a packet that we have prepared in support of Senate Bill 1011, providing you with additional reading material, because I understand at this late date in the session you have far too little to read. As I said again, Madam Chair, Brad Higbee on behalf of Vioxx Victims United. And we're here today on a very simple matter. The two pages that are being passed out currently illustrate the crux of the problem. But before I get into that, let me just say briefly that many of the people here today in support of Senate Bill 1011 are here because they need your help. They experienced a variety of causes of pain several years ago, knee surgeries, hip replacements, automobile accidents, and we're happy to have what had been billed at the time as a new super drug for the pain. And we're anxious to try one of these new, heavily promoted pharmaceutical products. However, the people sitting behind me, and likely many other thousands of folks in the Northwest,
have likely suffered a
debilitating stroke or heart attack as a result of taking COX-2 inhibitor products, including Vioxx, Celebrex, Bextra. And like many of us, if not all of us, we first discovered that potentially these products might have caused the stroke or heart attack that they had suffered some years ago on September 30th, 2004, when the manufacturer of Vioxx pulled it from the market in the wake of increasing evidence about the severity of the cardiovascular risks of the COX-2 inhibitor drugs. As I mentioned, these strokes and heart attacks for most of these people began right about the time that, in the case of Vioxx, that drug was first put on the market in June of 1999. Shortly thereafter, from all over the country, it seemed, people started experiencing heart attacks and strokes. People in this room have experienced heart attacks and strokes while taking COX-2 inhibitor drugs. And these occurred years ago, as I said, 1999, 2000, 2001. Because of that, and because of the way the statute of limitations for product liability civil actions has been regarded and amended by the legislature recently, these people fall into a gap. If they were lucky enough, if I could use that word, as I've mentioned to some of you before, I say that word advisedly, to have had a stroke after January, let's say, of 2004, we wouldn't be here today occupying the first part of your agenda. If they were lucky enough, again, I use that word advisedly, to have one of these cardiovascular events before June of 2001, they would have been just fine as well if they had initiated whatever claim for compensation that they wanted to initiate. But the problem, the crux of the problem, is illustrated in the two pages of materials that's been distributed to you as I was sitting down, not in the packet itself.
The statute of limitations
for product liability, originally adopted in 1977, as I understand it, said simply that you had 2 years from the time of the injury to file a civil action. Over the years and through several Oregon Courts of Appeals opinion, that was interpreted to mean 2 years from the injury, but you had to know about the injury. Therefore, as I understand the rules applied, you had 2 years from the injury or the discovery of that injury or who did it to you to file a legal action. The Oregon Supreme Court in June of 2001, ruled in the Gladhart case that that isn't what the statute actually says. They said the plain words are pretty plain. You only have 2 years from the time of the injury. Bless you.
Thank you.
That's where these people are starting to fall into a bit of a gap. Following the Supreme Court case, everybody that had an injury has 2 years to file a civil action. The legislature met last session to do a number of things for quite a long while, as I recall. But one of them was to fix this particular problem. Starting to have Judiciary Committee, their long hearings, and a bill is ultimately passed unanimously by this legislature, House Bill 2080. And they did essentially what any reasonable person would do. They restored the standard, made it explicit in statute, RS 30905, where an Oregon citizen has 2 years from the time of the injury or the discovery of the injury to file a civil action. The original version of the bill was pretty clear, intending to extend back a continuous application of what everybody had believed was the law prior to the court case in 2001, that people had 2 years from the injury or the discovery. An amendment was added, and that's what actually is in statute now, and I've highlighted it in that one of the two pages I submitted to you. It says, however, these new provisions, which are ideal, perfect, we have no difficulty with these provisions. We wish we would be falling under these provisions in a statute, but the amendment says, and is provided in ORS as a note, that these new provisions adopted last session are only available to injuries, to people with injuries occurring after January 1 of 2004. So what that means is, if you had an injury before that date, you're stuck with the old laws interpreted by the Supreme Court, with all respect. That means you have 2 years from the time of an injury to initiate an action for compensation against the manufacturer for an injury as a result of one of their products. No matter when you learned what it might have done to you or who might have done something to you, you had 2 years. So for that example I mentioned before when I was talking about the number of people that had cardiovascular events, if you had a stroke, as some people here did in the year 2000, you had 2 years to initiate a legal action. So by 2002, your time had run out. However, as I said initially, these people here, like virtually everybody else in this room, discovered September 30th, 2004, that it might very likely have been these COX-2 inhibitor drugs that had caused their stroke or heart attack. And by then, it had been years past the deadline for them to initiate any sort of legal action. So, Madam Chair, what we're hoping to do with this bill, Senate Bill 1011, very simply, is for this one narrow subset of people, restore the continuity of the 2 years from injury and 2 years from discovery provisions that existed before the Gladhart case, exist now after House Bill 2080, to this one unique subset of people. Some people have asked me, why aren't we doing this completely, changing the statute in its entirety, so that it's applicable to everybody for any injury that may or may not happen sometime in the future. Who knows what those things are? It's an interesting argument for some future debate. We're hoping to very humbly and simply move forward with a much narrower fix in a larger issue. Because we have a specific subset of people with an actual, genuine, identifiable, concrete problem because of the gap in continuity of the discovery standard, they're not able to initiate any sort of legal actions based on a discovery that occurred about 6.5 months ago.
despite the fact it could be now 5-6 years after their stroke. With that, Madam Chair, if I may, I might start inviting some of the folks behind me up. I hope they'll introduce themselves, and I've urged them to be succinct. And I will then, with your permission, come up to conclude or answer any questions you might have after they're done.
Thank you very much. I'll let you manage that, and we'll hold questions until all of them have had a chance to talk.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Moulton, I want to start first.
Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Moulton. I live in Eugene. I'm represented in Salem by Senator Morissette and Representative Barnhart. I am 43 years old, and I teach in the College of Business at Oregon State University. Approximately 10 weeks after filling my first prescription for Vioxx, I suffered a heart attack, and to survive, doctors performed emergency angioplasty and placed a stent in my heart. I will carry that stent for the rest of my life. I am in support of Senate Bill 1011 and its passage because it has a direct impact on my and other Oregonians' ability to seek remedy for the injuries that are potentially from Vioxx at the hands of Merck. I would also like you to realize that my claim of injury is not limited to just medical ailment. By having had a heart attack, I am no longer able to secure reasonable life insurance. If I ever leave my job, I will not be able to gain reasonable health insurance. The rest of my life has not only been medically impacted, but my ability to financially protect my family has been affected as well. Because of my heart attack was shortly after Vioxx came on the market in 1999, and public acknowledgement of Vioxx's potential involvement did not appear until recently, under current Oregon law, I am unable to pursue possible redress. I am not alone. Many Oregonians, as you've heard, took the drug shortly after its release, and if they also suffered injury, they too lack the ability for redress in their own state. Senate Bill 1011 does not open the door to a flood of pharmaceutical lawsuits that prior Oregon law has looked to minimize. Neither does the bill provide direct linkage that Vioxx or other COX-2 inhibitors were at fault in any given injury. Senate Bill 1011 merely gives some fellow state residents the ability to seek remedy if remedy is due. I strongly encourage you to consider this point. The bill is meant to uphold the rights to fair process. It is not meant to target any one firm. It is not meant to decide the validity of any given claim. Oregonians should be allowed their day in court for legitimate claims. In closing, I want to thank you for providing this time today for us to share our concerns with you, and I hope that you support Senate Bill 1011. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Madam Chair, if I can call up both the Euchards and the Larmies at this point.
Okay. Mike and Tony Euchard and Jamie and Cal, looks like Larmy. Please welcome. If you could give your name for the record before you start that.
My name is Mike Euchard, and this is my wife, Toni Euchard. My wife of almost 40 years was a very social person. She has very strong family ties, and she loved to play with and teach and counsel our grandsons. She worked for nearly 25 years for the Park Rose School District, the last years in administration offices. She was very proficient with the use of computers, and she loved working with them and teaching others about them. My wife and I had plans to travel when we retired. On August 2nd, 2002, 2 days after her 57th birthday, all that changed. She suffered a massive stroke. She lost a large portion of her left brain. This left her with no ability to communicate with speech, and she lost the right side of her body. Imagine not being able to perceive what your right eye is seeing, not being able to use the right side of your tongue, your throat, your hand, your leg, your foot, or your private parts. Strokes don't discriminate. Think of the personal trauma she feels, let alone that of her family and friends. Now imagine the frustration you feel a little better than 2 years after you find out about it, that it was preventable. A drug that you simply took for the relief of arthritis was the culprit. Imagine how frustrated you'd feel that because you live in the state of Oregon, you cannot have your day in court, simply because it's more than 2 years after your injury. This is my wife, Toni, and I love her very much. Nothing's going to change that. But as you can see, it's changed our life significantly. We now live in the basement of our home of nearly 29 years. We do this because our home is a split entry, and it has the fewest stairs to deal with. We're not asking the state to make a ruling on this case. That's for the courts to decide. We just want the opportunity to have our day in court. Ours is not the only story throughout this state, and we urge you, senators, to push this and pass Senate Bill 1011. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it very much your coming. Welcome to the committee.
Hello. My name is Jamie Larmy, and this is my husband, Cal Larmy.
Sorry. It's okay. Just take a minute. Would you like some water?
We're here today
That's okay. You just take as long as you need. We'll just wait until you feel ready to talk. And if you would like to wait until some other people have talked, we could do that as well.
No, I kind of want to get it over with.
Okay.
We're here today to support Senate Bill 1011. After my husband had some knee and back issues, he started taking Vioxx in 2001. One day after we returned from a camping trip, he was sitting on the couch in our living room, and without any warning to him physically, he had two stroke-like events. And no one knew what was the cause of this. So for over a year, he continued using Vioxx for his knee and his back pain. And on our daughter's wedding day, August 3rd, 2002, after walking her down the aisle, he had a stroke. My husband has always been a very smart man. Extremely intelligent, highly educated. There wasn't anything he couldn't do. I leaned on him for everything. He would fix our automobiles. He remodeled two of our homes. He built numerous decks for me. And he would counsel people on the side. He has worked for the state of Oregon for 20 years. He worked in human services. He was a high school counselor and a college instructor. Now life is no longer normal for us, and our life has been devastated. My husband is paralyzed on the right side, and he is confined to a wheelchair. No longer can he be the man that he was, and no longer can we have a normal life. Not only has Cal suffered, but so have our children and our grandchildren. So all we are asking for is our day in court, and this law prohibits us from even pursuing the chance at that. So we are asking to to find some restitution to this wrong. We are many lives being affected by this law, and we need it changed so at least we can have all sides heard from. We want to be able to seek justice because this wasn't due to lifestyle or age or health. And we are so disappointed in man's inhumanity to man. So we ask that you support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you all coming. I know it was difficult for you to get here, so thank you very much. Teresa Teeter.
Madam Chair, if I could just wrap up and be done with our particular panel.
Note for the record that we have written testimony from Jeffrey Bowersox that we will enter into the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if I could ask Christy to come up, she'll introduce herself in a second.
If you'll introduce yourself again for the record, that'd be great.
Again, Brad Higbee appearing in support of Senate Bill 1011. You've got a lot of material already in the packet. You've heard a lot from me. There's some additional material that's being distributed that goes into quite a bit more detail. One's a piece in the New England Journal of Medicine. Another is a New York Times article that gives a detail of the history behind some of the activity behind the marketing and results of the use of these COX-2 inhibitor drugs. In your packet as well, in the bound volume, there's also a copy of the Wall Street Journal article from November of 2004 that goes also into additional detail, highlighting some of the information they had access to, confidential emails and other materials that are currently under a gag order in court proceedings elsewhere. It's early in this process. Again, it was just 6.5 months ago that Merck pulled Vioxx from the market. It was just a week and a half ago that the FDA ordered Pfizer to pull Bextra and place the most stringent and severe of warnings directly on the label of that product. I would imagine as additional investigative reporting and litigation continues, more information will become generally available to the public about how far back into the history of the analysis and testing and marketing and promotion of these COX-2 inhibitor drugs, the evidence of the cardiovascular risk was readily apparent. With that, I just might introduce Christy, who will make a brief statement, and you can introduce yourself.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for allowing me to be here today. My name is Christy Schaefer. I'm a registered nurse, and my clinical specialty is neurological rehabilitation. I'm here today as the past president of and spokesperson for the Brain Injury Association of Oregon. The long-standing effects of stroke impacts not only the patient, but as we have seen today, the patient's family and community, and all Oregonians who may have to pay for that long-term expensive care. The Brain Injury Association of Oregon supports Senate Bill 1011. Victims of Vioxx need support services. It is unfair to deny them their day in court when they have significant medical needs and they could not possibly have known that Vioxx was the culprit behind their profound disability. The long-term cost for care for lifelong disabilities is enormous, and the impact both fiscally and emotionally is overwhelming. In most cases, the survivor eventually becomes dependent upon Medicare and Medicaid to provide rehabilitation and daily care. Our tax dollars are at work. The daily cost for care in a nursing home can reach as much as $350 a day, or nearly $128,000 per year. When a drug company produces a product and continues knowingly to put people at risk for heart attack or stroke, that company should be held accountable. It is up to you, the people that we elected, please, to help us now by passing Senate Bill 1011.
Thank you. Madam Chair, to conclude, and I'll subject myself now to questions or later, it's your call. I just wanted to say that, again, you've heard a lot here about these three COX-2 inhibitor drug products. But basically, again, as I started off with, the issue here is the gap in the statute of liability, the difference between before and after the Gladhart case, discovery and the date of the injury. The application of the way the law works here is a rarity. Only a handful of states apply a law that would be like this law applies to the folks that have fallen into this gap. Virtually every other state, as I understand it, has both the injury and discovery provisions available to folks that might have suffered through injuries from COX-2 inhibitor drugs. And finally, as you've heard a number of times here, whether or not you agree with this, whether or not you like or dislike the companies that produce these products, and whether or not you wanted to go to school, become a research chemist, and determine for yourself whether or not there are some imminent risks or what was and wasn't readily available. Again, all we're asking you for is, in the name of fairness, a chance to have access to justice. They might not win, they might not prevail, they might not be able to prove anything, but right now, they don't even have the chance. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. We will entertain questions for this panel. Senator Pazanski.
Thank you. Mr. Higbee, I'm sorry I would have missed your first presentation as the Legislative Council. Can you just tell me, if you already covered this, I can get it off the tapes, as to when it was first discovered, as to the companies involved with these type of prescription drugs had knowledge of that there may be a problem? I'm looking at the New York Times article that you provided us on November 14th of 2004. My quick glancing at a review appears that they may have known something as early as May or prior to May of 2002. And I wonder if you actually have a date that might be prior to that time frame.
Madam Chair, Senator Pazanski, I do, and in the bound packet, the Wall Street Journal article, as well as the New York Times article, and the document from the New England Journal of Medicine, is as a beginning to tease out what evidence might actually be there, what sort of documentation, internal communication might exist. From those sources, it appears that as far back as 1996, internal communications with respect to Merck, anyway, was ongoing about potentially the cardiovascular risks inherent in this particular drug. And in particular, I believe that was something that was mentioned in conjunction with how best to model and tailor a study to determine whether or not this product they hoped to market was, in fact, safe.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. We'll now take Jim Gardner from Pharma.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner, and I'm appearing today for Pharma, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. And it is with some trepidation that I must voice opposition to this bill. It's impossible to sit here and hear these stories without being moved by them and without feeling deep sympathy for these individuals. But I want to focus on a decision that was made last session by this body, I think in a very careful and deliberative way. As Mr. Higley said, the decision was embodied in House Bill 2080, and it was prompted, as I think a number of you will recall, by the Oregon Supreme Court's decision in the Gladhart case. The effect of that decision was to essentially impose what is known as a statute of repose, a two-year statute of repose on product liability actions. And with the leadership of the then chair of the House Judiciary Committee, Max Williams, the parties on both sides of the plaintiff defendant divide, the Trial Lawyers Association and the business community, which I took a lead role in kind of trying to develop some ideas on, tried to work a compromise that would essentially overturn what we came to view as a misreading of the statute by the Oregon Supreme Court, a misconstruction of legislative intent. And That is summarized in the measure summary analysis for 2080A engrossed, which I passed out. That passed out of this committee unanimously, and it passed out with the support of both the Trial Lawyers Association and the business community. Inevitably, statutes of repose and statutes of limitations are about line drawing. They will create hardships in individual cases. But the fact is, a statute of limitations serves the purpose of placing some curbs and limitations on litigation. It was a considered decision by this committee and the committee on the House side and by the full body to effectuate and validate the compromise that was House Bill 2080. And I don't know that I'm going to be able to persuade you about what you ought to do. I simply want you to consider the fact that that was your deliberate decision last session.
To your knowledge, Mr. Gardner, was anyone aware during consideration of this legislation last session that the use of these COX-2 inhibitors might be associated with increased risk of heart attack or stroke? Was that even on the radar screen?
Madam Chair, not to my knowledge.
So do you concede that people were having these potential ill effects, whether or not, I mean, that's for a court to determine what the cause was, but these things had happened without any connection to these drugs?
Madam Chair, I think that issue was not known to my knowledge.
Right. And, well, I think it's the job of the legislature to make the statutes respond to information as we become aware of it. And there's no way we could have taken this issue into account during the last session when nobody knew about it.
Yeah. Madam Chair, the only thing I would add is that inevitably when you impose a statute of repose or a statute of limitations, you are going to draw lines on claims. That's just the inevitable consequence of it.
Correct. Other questions? Senator Pazansky.
Thank you. Mr. Gardner, I appreciate your being here and willingness to set forth as to what happened last session. Since I was on the House side at that time, I vaguely remember that this was one of those issues. I think Chair Williams was attempting to have some type of resolution done, knowing what the Supreme Court had done in the Gladhart case. Would it be fair to say that if we knew today, if we knew 2 years ago what we know today, that the line may have been drawn differently?
Madam Chair, Senator Pazansky, I think that's a possibility. I really don't feel I can speculate on that, but that certainly is a possibility.
And my other understanding, and I have not been able to go back over the records from last session, is that this portion of where we're, let's say, being asked to rethink and maybe read this line may have resulted in an amendment that came in toward the end through the negotiations that actually has got us in the position where we are now looking at whether or not what has been put in place based on House Bill 2080 from the 03 session should be redefined. Do you remember during the negotiations if the pharmaceutical product liability issues were basically, let's say, carved out and given this, I'm going to, lack of better terms, protection of where the line was drawn based on an amendment that was put into the final bill from those negotiations?
Madam Chair, Senator Pazansky, there was no pharmaceutical specific amendment. There was, and the amendment, as I recall, occurred on the House side, mm-hmm. So it was not amended on the Senate side.
Right.
And it was the line that was drawn was essentially a attempt to deal with the glad heart decision, but to draw it in a way that essentially could garner support from both the plaintiff side and from the broader business community, not so much pharma, but the broader business community.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Brzezinski. Are there other questions from the committee? Thank you very much. We are now going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 10. I was going from the sign up. Is there anybody else who would like to testify? Please do come up. I thought you were included in the group that he said
you
don't want to
speak. Oh, better go first.
Go ahead.
I'm off meds now. I'm paying attention.
If you could be very
my
brief.
My rights today, baby.
If you could be very brief, we'd appreciate it.
Sorry. Oh, here you go, sir. Sorry. I'm here today.
You identify yourself.
Yes, Teresa Teeter, Oregon City, Oregon.
Thank you.
Wayne Scott's my person, and Kurt Schrader, veterinarian. Excuse me. There's a really high standard in Oregon, by the way, for veterinarians, medication for dogs and drugs, etc. Thought I'd put that in there while I could. So Mr. Schrader would probably pay attention to this bill today, too. I made some quick notes. I wanted to mention we have a 30-year statute of limitations in Oregon for childhood sexual abuse because victims repress memories, or maybe they don't, but they don't realize what it's related to while they're acting out, whatever, et cetera, rehabilitation. I would like to see that liberally, maybe not 30 years for pharmaceutical lawsuits, but, you know, a generous 7 to 10 year statute of limitations for people to recover from damages. I've put inserts in there for you regarding Pfizer Corporation and my run-in with them with the Neurontin pill, which was meant for epileptic seizures and not for the 8 unapproved things that they had marketed and promoted it for, and the FDA fined them last year $480 million. A bunch of people in America died on that medication, and it just all came to light within May 14th last year. So some of my injuries were realized from that medication. I downloaded some things from the FDA for you on the Vioxx testimony from Congress so you could familiarize yourself. Ironically, when I was doing some research yesterday, a medication I was on, along with this Neurontin and Celexa and all this other stuff, Seroquel came up. 2 days ago, they pulled it off the market for elderly people all over the country. It causes death in people with dementia, elderly people. I was on it for the last 2 years. It causes instant heart failure, sudden death, or infection from pneumonia. I've been at Willamette Falls Hospital about 15 times in the last 2 years while on Seroquel with pneumonia. My potassium levels dropped off to a 2 last year. In the summer, I thought I was dying, and it was because probably this pill. I don't know. I have to go research it now, and then I got to hire Mr. Dollar Socks and Savage and Superstein again for this one. I'm just a walking effect machine from 3 pharmaceutical companies right now in America that are all in class action on 3 out of 4 products I've been on. Most of them are not approved by the FDA for consumption. These are things you probably don't know about. I really would like to see you amend into this bill that all pharmaceutical products be included for the state of Oregon. You folks don't convene again until 2007. That's 2 years from now. That's 4 years down the road from when my victimization happened, and I'm still researching where I need to go find the answers and to get help. And I need this, like, we called it Christmas tree in Nebraska on legislative bills back, you Christmas tree it in there. You put it under the tree and get it in this bill. I don't want to ruin this bill for the folks that are here today. I feel just as bad as they do. I've suffered consequences. It's in my testimony. I was homeless 6 months after I started medication because I couldn't hold down a job anymore. I held a job for 15 years in Nebraska driving a dump truck. On the Wanton in Oregon, by state law, you can't drive a vehicle, and I was, because I didn't have epilepsy. But that's what that drug was meant for. But I was given it for post-traumatic stress. It induced bipolar symptoms and some other things, which I now supposedly don't have after all. And I've got to figure out what's related to what, who to blame, and help. You know, I need a bill that protects me while I'm doing my research. So I really would appreciate you Christmas treeing in. A whistleblower from Park Davis Division worked there for 4 months and got the information that's on your FDA report on the $480 million fine. 4 months he worked there and documented all the evidence of them lying about the marketing of their product. And he walked off with $26 million last year. He won his lawsuit. He's on a beat somewhere. He can't ever be employed again because nobody will trust him. He didn't ingest any pills, but he gathered the evidence and set a bunch of us free so we know what's going on now. And that statute of limitation is running, and I need protection so I can still file my suit.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Teeter. Your written comments.
Great.
I appreciate you submitting them. I want the committee to draw your attention to some of the documents that she submitted from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Thank you. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
Yes. Good afternoon. My name is Ed Johnson from Toledo, Oregon. And definitely I'm one of those victims as well. I was on Vioxx, Celebrex, Naprosyn. And 2002, I did go through a small stroke. I did talk to my physician about it, and I was told don't blame the pharmaceutical company. It had nothing to do with it. Plus, I have high blood pressure and lung problems. I don't know if that's related, but I heard that after I started taking all this medication. The reason why I was to take this medication, 3 through 7 of my neck is blown. 3-4 is going in the spinal cord. 6-7 is in the spinal cord. C4 through 6 is titanium plated now. I have T1 and 2 herniated. I have L4 through S1 herniated going in the spinal cord. So I'm a severe chronic pain patient. So when it comes out that they used me and everybody else as I would refer it, as a guinea pig, and we were the guinea pigs. To me, we need something that protects us, and we're asking the Senate to pass this bill to look forward because we don't want the citizens to take it in their own hands. I listened to a comment from the gentleman from the representing the pharmaceutical company. He said something about the business community supported all this. Well, I don't think the business community would support it. I'm part of the business community. I sure would not have supported this if I'd known what was going on. Most of you people on the panel are part of the business community as well. So, you know, if you own businesses or something like that, it's all part of the business community. We're all part of the business community. We're all part of it. So what gets to me about it is being used as guinea pigs for these pharmaceutical companies. Someday we got to put a stop. I have turned my medical records in this Senate floor for the last 4 years. And those medical records prove the medications that I have been on, and Vioxx is one of them, Baxter, Celebrex, and Naprosyn. So to me is that if this Senate does not protect its citizens, maybe the citizens need to look elsewhere for protection. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Okay, now if there's nobody else who wishes to testify on this, we will close the hearing on Senate Bill 1011. I want to thank you all for coming. And we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 990. Council. While we're waiting for the hearing on Senate Bill 990, we will open a work session on Senate Bill 198 for purposes of moving that to Monday's agenda. Close the work session on Senate Bill 198. Reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 990. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 990 would reduce the membership of the Board of Public Safety Standards and Trainings. It would also reduce the number of votes needed for the board to disapprove a policy, a requirement, a standard, or a rule of a policy committee. Under the current law, the governor appoints 24 members to the board, and this measure would reduce it to 15.
Okay, we have three people signed up in favor of this. We'll bring them all three up at once. Brian DeLashmet, Bob Livingston, and Mary Botkin. Let's get everybody up to the table.
Livingston's not here.
Why don't you guys go ahead and get started. Welcome to committee.
For the record, Brian DeLeishmet, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations, the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, and the Federation of Oregon Parole and Probation Officers, three of the statewide organizations that represent public safety officers in this state. Actually, this bill comes at the request of the Oregon Council of Police Associations, but after several sessions of thought, rumination on this issue, and I know it's not a new issue to at least some members of this committee. You'll likely hear later, I know he has signed up, the director of the DPSST, who was the former chair of this committee, and when he was the chair, there was numerous discussions about what is the right membership, should we be adding members, who should be on the DPSST board, and when we had those discussions during the last legislative session, there was at least, I believe, an agreement with the governor's office that there would be some kind of an interim working group to start talking about the composition of this board, what it was too big, what the right membership was, and how it functioned. And I had at least five occasions in which I had discussions with staff from the governor's office about this and kept being told, yeah, we'll get to it. We just haven't got there yet. We've got a new director, and Director Minnis was new to the division at that time. And the end result was we didn't get to it. There was no discussions during the interim about the composition. So in a subsequent meeting with the governor early in the session, I brought up the issue that we didn't get to it, and he said, well, he gave me lobbying advice after me being in the building for 27 years. He said, well, write down what you want and bring the bill forward. So what you see in front of you today is my idea of what should be done with the DPSST board. First, let me say that 24 members on any board or commission in the state is way out of hand. A board, whether you're a fiscal conservative or someone on the other leanings of the aisle, 24 members on a board in which you have to function, you have to send literature to 24 members, you have to get them to meetings, you have to achieve a quorum is totally unmanageable. So my first assignment was, okay, what's the right number? And I'll tell you, I spent several evenings going through the current composition and trying to figure out not only who shouldn't be on the board and who should be on the board, but what is the right number? Well, I'll tell you, 15 is no magical number. I got it to 15 only because I went through and I tried to figure out who are the appropriate people given the function both of training and reviewing certifications, disciplinary actions that this board takes. 15 is no magical number. So let me tell you right up front that this bill, I'm open to suggestions for alterations, changes, if the other parties want to have that discussion. But this bill in front of you is at least the start of the discussion about what is the right number, what is the right composition, and what is the function of this board. With that, I guess I will answer any questions. The one additional thing I would say to you is that in the composition, although there is increased membership from line staff and there's some decreased membership from those folks that are not line staff, it is not and should not be viewed as a labor versus management argument or discussion in the composition. I can think of no other board in this state, and I represent a number of professionals, including nurses, in which if you looked at the composition of the board, it was so top-heavy on those folks that are at the very top level of their management or their organization, and so light on those people that are actually doing the function. If, in fact, an issue of sanction or lifting of somebody's certification were to come in front of this board, it is not a jury of your peers. It is, in fact, people who may not have been on the street for a number of years and do not understand or potentially could not understand the ramifications or the situation that those individual officers were under during that particular case. So with that, I'll wrap it up, and I'll answer any questions.
Thank you very much. I think we'll take Ms. Bodkin, and if you could keep it brief, that's great. I just looked up at the clock with horror.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Bodkin, and I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. You know, I don't have a lot to add to what Mr. DeLashman's already said. I agree with everything he said, that we worked very hard on this last session in an attempt to find some solution. We agreed to work on an interim work group to find sort of what the magic number is and how many sheriffs do you need, how many chiefs of police do you need. And just quite frankly, that didn't happen. You know, I could nitpick Brian's bill. It makes no sense to me to do that. When we first looked at the board seriously, what we found was it did not represent the makeup of Oregon in any manner, shape, or form. It didn't was not demographically diverse, and it was not structurally diverse in recognition of the changing world of public safety. There was one or two women on the board. We finally got a female corrections officer on the board just to acknowledge the fact that women do work in prisons. There are structurally, I think that there are probably things we could do differently. I'm with Brian. I don't know what the magic number is. I know that 24 was not the magic number, and we really do need to take a look at structurally how the board functions and how it's made up. And we need to make sure that everybody's being treated the same. We pay for our members to come to the board meetings. Taxpayers pay for their management counterparts to come to the board meetings. And, you know, I mean, to me that's just offensive that we're not treating the folks who are on the street or walking the tiers the same as we're treating the folks who supervise them. And so we really need to think about how we do that. And, you know, we need to make sure people can get off to be at the board meetings. And, you know, and I do have to say that of all the directors that I've had at DPSST, we have the honor of representing the folks who actually work at DPSST. I have to tell you that former Senator Minnis is a delight to work with on most days.
on his good
you days. Know, if he was a delight to work with every day, he wouldn't be the boss. So, but we do try to work in conjunction with what's best for the training academy, and I think we do that. This board is just too big and too cumbersome.
Thank you very much.
You.
Are there questions from the committee?
And just for the record, Bob Livingston had signed up. He had another obligation. As a board member, he had some insight as to the workings of this board at 24 members.
All right. Thank you for passing that on. We'll try to meet him in the sidebar. Did you have a question, Senator Barr? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. John Powell and John Minnis. Looks like we have the students from Grants Pass entering the room. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you.
You're about to hear testimony from the former chair of this committee. Welcome, Mr. Minnis.
Madam Chair, Judiciary Committee, thank you very much. I was looking for my backup in John Powell. Apparently he's committed somewhere else.
He's got you back somewhere. He's just not here.
Madam Chair, I did submit some brief testimony and some additional information to the committee for reference only. And I guess I'll begin by saying that I am John Minnis. I'm the Director of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. The very point that my testimony makes is one that was just recently made by Mr. DeLashman, and that is that the board ought not be really viewed as a labor management forum, and I think that's really the salient point is the point of my discussion here. So without going into the testimony and talking about what the statutes say relevant to our purpose and the reason why we exist, other than to say that the sole reason that we exist is to develop standards within the profession, and that's the profession notwithstanding the rank or position that any person holds within the public safety arena that are governed by this agency. My objective as the director of the agency is to bring all of these individual groups together, be they labor, management, or what have you, so that we can build the best possible training facility and training curriculum for basic training programs, but also for intermediate, advanced, leadership management, and executive development training that we can possibly bring to Oregon public safety workers. And I got to tell you, I think that the discussion that Mr. DeLashman brought to you with respect to whatever conversations may have existed prior to my appointment and his concern about the size of this committee, I will admit that I did have discussions with him about similar concerns about the construct of the board and perhaps whether or not it was too large. Having been there some 15 months now, and I've told Mr. DeLashman this, it's my diagnosis that the problem isn't the size of the board, because if you may recall how the board functions, we have five policy committees that exist under the full 24-member board. Those policy committees are discipline-specific, and that is where the substantive work occurs in terms of revocation issues or review of curriculum that may become incorporated in the training programs that are part of the DPSST system. And what my diagnosis would basically tell you is that I don't believe that the interaction or relationship that existed between the board and my agency was a healthy relationship. That in fact the prior administration, for whatever reason, did not engage the board or the constituents, for that matter, in discussions relevant to what the training for public safety workers ought to be, either then or as it might relate to what it should look like in the future. My leadership and the leadership of my team within the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training had embraced the concept of customer service being a central principle regarding how we deal with our constituents and how we deal with each other internally within the department. So our objective is to bring individuals like the Oregon Council of Police Associations and other groups that are represented, AFSCME and others, into the mix so that we can very well meet the needs of the constituent groups in terms of providing the best possible training and adjudicating the cases in a way that are both fair, reasonable, and provide sufficient due process to meet the requirements of law. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony and certainly open myself to any questions.
Thank you. Did you have any comment on his on Ms. Botkin's point that the management people are paid for basically to come to the meetings and the union people have to get payment from the union?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I do believe that there's a substitute bill in this legislature dealing with the issue of some individuals represented by labor organizations who have at least been, in particular, has denied the ability to go and attend the meetings themselves. As far as the department is concerned, we have a small area of our budget that pays per diem and travel costs for every board member, whether they're labor, management, or what have you. So with respect to what the individual agency who employ the members of our board might do on behalf of their members, I wouldn't have a direct knowledge of their reimbursement or remuneration for those folks.
Are there questions from the committee? Senator Barr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Menace, who's in charge of this board? Who chairs it?
The board is chaired by Bob Tardif, who is the chief of police in the Newburgh Police Department, Newburgh, Oregon.
I guess, specifically, do they elect their own chair?
They do, as a board, and they also elect the vice chair.
Okay, follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you, and maybe you don't know, but there seems to be, besides the reduction in the size of the board, on page 4 of the bill, line 39, there seems to be a policy change to go from a two-thirds to a three-fifths vote by the members of the board to disapprove of a policy requirement. No one has spoken to that. Do you care to?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, from my experience over the last 15 months, the vast majority, not all, but the vast majority of the cases coming before the board have been voted on unanimously in terms of the decisions coming from the policy committees. There have been several votes that had a one or two vote to no votes. on the action of the policy committee. So as it relates to two-thirds versus three-fifths, I guess my impression would be it wouldn't make any difference.
Thank you. One more, and I don't know if you can answer this question, but I noticed that most, if not all, the members of the board are, it defines the category of person they are, and it says recommended to the governor by a certain group. Does the governor have to choose from that recommended, or can the governor go outside the recommendation and choose a person?
Madam Chair, I don't know the specific answer to that. I do believe that as there are usually in appointments by the governor, there are negotiations with organizations that might want to nominate or send someone's name forward for nomination by the governor to the board, but I'm not party to the vast majority of those discussions.
Thank you. Madam Chair, does council know in this language, does that require the governor to choose a person from that group, or is that just a recommendation, and the governor can choose outside of that recommendation?
Madam Chair, Senator Beyer, I don't have any inside knowledge of the practice. I would be relying on the plain language of the statute to answer your question.
No, Chair, Senator Beyer, the tradition has been that the governor traditionally does follow through with the suggested appointment by the organization mentioned in statute, but I don't know of a situation where the governor's departed from that.
I appreciate that. I would like to know if what that means when it says recommended, if the governor has to choose someone from that nomination or someone from that group nominates or not. And if they do, I think we need to check into that, because I don't think that's constitutional.
All right. Do you have anything more to add?
Mr. Dleishmidt reminds me that it goes back to a negotiation discussion, that if the governor does not like the name forwarded by the association, the governor would then ask that another name be submitted.
Thank you. Senator Pazanski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John, regarding the people that are on this list and the size and the number, can you tell us how often they're able to conduct business? Do they get a quorum? How that all works as to making sure it's efficient and effective.
Madam Chair and Senator, there have been problems in the past with the board being able to get a quorum. I think that, at least in my tenure, we have not had a similar problem. And I think one of the functional difficulties had more to do with the department and the way the department may be disseminating information to the board prior to board meetings and perhaps soliciting their attendance, whereas today we're providing information and documentation on the cases that are coming from the policy committees well in advance of their attendance, and then doing our due diligence to ensure that people are available for the committee meetings. The other thing that we do, they are allowed to testify by phone or telephonically and participate in the meetings, and we do often have persons participating by telephone during the meetings. Again, they get the packets of information and all the various cases and documented information that's provided relevant to a particular revocation or a rule that's being made permanent, usually about 2 weeks prior to the meetings.
If I could follow up.
Yes.
So that what I'm hearing is that, one, since you've taken over, it seems like it's not been a problem. Just put on the record, one, how frequently they are meeting, and what I've also understand is that the rules do provide for individuals to be participants, where they're not in person but by telecommunication system.
And that's correct. In addition to that, they meet four times a year by statute or at the call of the chair. There's usually one meeting that occurs at Seaside, Oregon, where the PSATs meeting or the law enforcement leadership meeting training also occurs, and the board moves its program there. The 28th of this month, we're having the board meeting in Salem to coincide with a training that the department is sponsoring with the Oregon Executive Development Institute. Is a training on officer-involved shootings and psychological impacts of that. There is also in statute an executive committee of the board that meets more frequently, and that is basically the leadership of the full board, and those would be the chairs of the policy committee plus the chair of the committee. I meet with those individuals personally and spend a great deal of time talking to them about the direction of the agency and where they might want the agency to go in terms of the pursuit of training modalities and issues that they'd like us to bring forward to the full board. And the board chair is responsible for setting the agenda. We've also changed the format of the board since I've come on. What we have done is that because of the threshold for overcoming the action of a policy committee, we have consolidated most of those actions into a consent calendar, much like the Senate or the House may have a consent calendar, where any member of the board has the privilege to remove one of those actions from that consent calendar if they so choose, and it's at the request of the member of the board. And then post that consent calendar vote, which is a single motion, we have now entered into broader discussions about the future of the agency and how we should be responding, for instance, in the development of a 16-week curriculum. We're currently going to be doing some things with racial profiling, mental health issues, the development, obviously the building of the facility and how that facility is constructed. There are also discussions with respect to the corrections side of what we do. There are discussions about expanding the training, changing the modality of training, curriculum, etc., jail managers and so on and so forth have one idea about how it ought to be accomplished. DOC perhaps has another. So it's really a very inclusive and open discussion with those board members. I think before my tenure, quite frankly, I don't believe that much of those discussions occurred very openly.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions?
Yes, Mr.
Starr.
Yeah, Mr. Starr, what's up? Director Minnis, I've served on some boards and so forth over the years, and it's what's kind of disturbed me, as a private individual, you pay your own way, and the agency individuals usually are compensated for being there. I would be, to go back to the compensation thing, would it be possible for your department to compile cost estimates from all agencies on per diem travel and time cost for participation on this board for this committee?
Yeah, sure. Senator, certainly we could do that because we do reimburse the vast majority of the members, so we would have all of the financial references relevant to what they might ask for reimbursement with respect to hotels or mileage or other food costs that they might incur while they're here, if that's the question you're asking.
Yes, and then is there any way to quantify the time lost from their agency?
Well, I'm sure that we could ask the board members to provide that information. Usually it's 1 or 2 days because the board meetings are usually not longer than 1 4-hour period. So I would assume travel time, depending. Some of the folks that may be coming from LeGrand or Ontario, Oregon, and other distant locations may stay overnight. So it's a 2-day trip.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure we could do that.
That'd be very helpful. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Tremendous.
Appreciate it.
Council has an answer for Senator Beyer's question, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Beyer, the question you posed was whether or not the governor was required to appoint, I believe was required to appoint those members for which the language includes a person recommended by to the governor by the particular association. My answer, based on the language of the statute and the context of other sections, is that while the governor is not required to appoint that person, that it would be required that both the particular association and the governor agree to that person. So I think that it could only be a person that both the governor and the association agreed to. And I base that on the fact that there are other individuals listed, such as members of non-management, representatives of law enforcement, that are appointed by the governor but are not based on the recommendation of anyone. So whichever legislative assembly enacted the statute, they made differentiations between those two for some reason, and I think that the requirement is implied that both the association and the governor agree to those particular members.
Madam Chair, can I follow up?
Please do.
I don't see these members are confirmed by the Senate in any way, are they?
They keep talking.
I don't see confirmation. Senate confirmation.
There is Senate confirmation. Yeah.
We got the nods from both
Okay. Can we ask Legislative Council to come to when this was done? Because I know that in the late 80s, I think it was, maybe early 90s, that other boards and commissions, and specifically at that time, the under the Bureau of Forestry was one, but some others, where the statute required, the statutes at that time required the governor to choose from people brought forward by associations, was declared unconstitutional, and that was changed. So I'd like to know if that, if this has been looked at since then, and get Legislative Council to give us an opinion on that issue.
I'll follow up on that, sir.
Yeah, I think it's more in the line of information rather than opinion.
Yeah.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, we will...
John Powell's here now.
Oh, that's right. Mr. Powell never got called up. Welcome. We're going to ask you to be really brief.
I will,
because we have a short meeting.
I apologize for not being in the room. I'm one witness away from testifying in Ways and Means right now, so I'll speak quickly.
Well, then you will hurry.
I will. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. Sheriff Wolf, Polk County, is a member of this board, and he's this year's president of our association. And he wanted me to relay his strong opposition and the opposition of the association to the passage of this bill. But any time in this agency's history, this is not the time to shrink the board, both in terms of participation and its makeup. This agency has, I think, turned a corner. It is dealing with the very essential needs of training, and that should be its focus and continue to be its focus. And I think it, in the last year, has had a proven record of doing that, lengthening the training, the new facilities now being constructed. And we would just oppose violently changing the makeup of the board right now. If there are issues of people not being able to get to meetings because of pay or other things, then those problems should be dealt with specifically and not with an overhaul of the board.
Thank you. Are there questions? Thank you very much. We will close the hearing on Senate Bill 990, and I'm going to try to do a quick work session here on Senate Bill 850. Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 850 is the measure that creates the address confidentiality program within the Department of Justice for victims of domestic violence, sexual assault, and stalking who have relocated because of threats to their safety. There is a -3 amendment before you that is the product of a work group involving multiple stakeholders, most of whom I think are present here in the gallery today. This clarifies several issues that I will just quickly touch on. First, it clarifies that the courts are not required to redact information in court files that they receive regarding an actual address of a participant in this Attorney General program. It also clarifies that a person may not attempt to obtain the actual address of a participant from the Attorney General through fraud or misrepresentation. It also lists a district attorney to the list of officials who can request and receive the participant's actual address from the Attorney General, and it allows the Attorney General to verify that a person is a participant when requested by a public body. It deletes the requirement of the Department of Revenue that would be required to provide them with the actual address. Apparently, the Department of Revenue said they didn't need that. And it also prohibits a person from attempting to obtain or fraud misrepresentation. Sorry, I already said that one. And then finally, the amendment gives the Attorney General the authority to set a time period on a person's participation in the program by administrative rule.
Okay, and would you go over again who was a member of this work group, what groups were a member of that?
I'm going to help with a show of hands. Sybil Hebb, Ronald Schenkel, Brad Swank, John Hummel.
So we had all sides. I want to compliment the work group for reaching such a speedy decision, and it seems to be a very reasoned decision. Senator Starr, do you have a recommendation on the -3 amendment?
Madam Chair, I appreciate the work, and I move the -3 amendments to Senate Bill 850.
Senator Starr has moved the -3 amendment to Senate Bill 850. Is there a discussion? Are there objections? So ordered. Senator Starr?
Move Senate Bill 850 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Starr has moved Senate Bill 850 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there a discussion?
Question. Thank you, Madam Chair. I see the staff in the summary says has minimal fiscal but no statement issued. Do we have a fiscal statement issued for the bill yet?
Madam Chair, Senator Byer, if you could just give me a moment. I still have no fiscal.
Okay, I will wait for Brad Swank to jump up and down on that point if we've overlooked something. Okay, I think we're all clear on that, Senator Byer. No fiscal.
By that I mean I have no statement.
You have no statement.
Yes.
Okay.
There obviously is going to be a fiscal. There has to be a fiscal because the Department of Justice has to gather this mail up and then forward it on to people.
Well,
I don't know what that amount is.
There are some tasks here. I guess the question I would follow with what Senator Byer is asking, do we know, Council, whether or not it was has come in at all as to being minimal, that they don't see it to being anything of substance?
Madam Chair, Senator Prozonsky, to clarify, this measure may have a fiscal impact, but I have received no statement from legislative fiscal.
Okay. Was it your sense that they just haven't gotten to it, or is it likely to be minimal? Because we'll have to hold it if it's going to require a Ways and Means referral, we'd be best off holding it. Kevin Neely is entering the arena here. Thank you for helping us out here. You may get a reward for this. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Burdick. For the record, Kevin Neely, Executive Assistant to Attorney General Hardy Myers and the Fiscal Coordinator for the Department of Justice. And we did submit a fiscal on this. And Ronell had it in her little packet because she's always more prepared than I am. $33,000. And I believe that we will be, and I think the fiscal will be borne almost entirely by the Department of Justice on this, and we will work with our legislative fiscal officer to get the limitation needed for this. But I don't believe that there's any, we aren't perceiving this to be any general fund impact.
Senator Prozonsky?
And I'm assuming that this would not be general funds, but would be other funds.
Yes.
Madam Chair.
Okay, we're getting a nod on that too. Yeah, Senator Byer?
What's the source of those other funds?
The victims.
Ms. Shankle, did you want to come up here too? Or?
I suspect this is me. I'm not sure I have an answer to that question, Senator Byer. I apologize. I can come back with that.
Ms. Neely, wouldn't it be from the victims' funds, from the assessments that
I
are
think it's likely
in?
To come from the work in our crime victims' assistance section. But again, I can't say that unequivocally. I know that the fiscal came in from that shop, and so I think it's a safe bet that fund would pay for
but
the
this
cost.
Will not require a general fund appropriation.
That's correct.
Why we send things away from Council?
Just Senator Prozonsky and Senator Byer to add that the reason that LFO has not given us a final fiscal yet is the amendment, the -3 amendment that's before you, came in yesterday. It was forwarded to them yesterday, and they cannot issue a final fiscal statement, no matter what information they have, until the committee decides whether or not to move the amendment.
Okay. Well, I don't think the bill is going to move without the amendment. The question is, based on this information, are people comfortable sending it on? It has no general fund impact. I'm comfortable, but there's only five of us here, so... Up to you.
Well, Madam Chair, the reason I ask the question is because almost all of the Department of Justice funds are other funds, but many of those other funds start out as a general fund in an agency, and then when the Department of Justice charges the agency for real work, that general fund becomes other fund. So that's why I'm inquiring is to make sure that we're not talking something that had been general fund and became other funds just because of its pass-through.
Senator Prozonsky?
These funds, if I remember correctly, Ms. Jankoff may want, or we may want to get someone else up here, are all coming out of the assessments through the crime victims assessments through the unitary assessment. It's broken out, so it wouldn't be coming from another agency. I feel pretty comfortable that it would be based on what is coming into the courts through the post or the the ordering of fines being paid and fees that are attached to those fines.
We have a representative from Senator Devlin's office here.
Yes.
Would you introduce yourself to the record, please?
For the record, Shelby Rahal, Senator Devlin's office. It was our anticipation that this bill would be forwarded with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Senator Devlin did anticipate that it would go there.
Oh, that's the first we have learned of that.
Yeah.
We're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 850. I don't know if we need to withdraw.
You're right, we've already adopted the amendments, haven't we?
Yeah, we adopted the amendment, and that's fine.
That should generate a fiscal statement out of fiscal then.
Yeah, so we will close the work session on Senate Bill 850, which already has the Dash 3 amendment adopted, and we'll get to the bottom of this. Okay. We don't have Rangor. Charles, how are you on the Dash 7? Do you know Rogers is holding it?
That's the issue. So you've got
We're going to reopen the work session on Senate Bill 850 for the purpose of withdrawing the motion to send it to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation with Senator Starr's permission.
Yes, Madam Chair, I withdraw my motion to move Senate Bill 850 to the Senate floor. The understanding that we perhaps will be moving that to Ways and Means on further revelation.
Appreciate that, Senator Starr. We will withdraw that motion, and we will carry Senate Bill 850 till Monday's meeting and close the work session on Senate Bill 850. Okay. I think we'll have a brief hearing now on Senate Bill 264. Counsel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 264 would require that grand jury proceedings be on the record and provides for disclosure of the recorded grand jury testimony to a defendant if an indictment is returned.
We have, where's that sign up? We have John Hummel and John Henry Hinkson signed up, but I can't find, there we go. Committee, sorry for the late time. Our whole schedule was thrown off by a late floor session today.
That's okay. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, my name is John Hummel. I'm a criminal defense attorney in Bend, and today I'm representing the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. OCDLA has a fundamental belief that justice should not be administered in secret. Conducting government business in public is sometimes cumbersome, occasionally results in embarrassment, and is oftentimes opposed by those in power. However, it is the right thing to do. The arguments against an open grand jury process would be the exact same arguments one would make in favor of closing our courts to public scrutiny. However, if someone introduced a bill to close our courts to public scrutiny, they would be greeted with mockery. Why is that? Because of our nation's fundamental principle that justice should occur in public. That same principle should apply equally to grand juries. I'm going to introduce my colleague, John Henry Hinkson. He lives in Boring. He practices in Oregon City. He's a past president of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers and a past president of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. He's a preeminent scholar in the area of grand jury law, and he's one of our nation's top trial attorneys. So I'll turn it over to John Henry Hinkson.
Welcome to committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. It's an honor to appear before you and to at least to have my voice heard on what I consider to be a most important topic. Grand juries in Oregon
Could you give your name for the record?
Oh, I'm so sorry. It's John Henry Hinkson III, and I'm a criminal defense lawyer, and I practice in Oregon City, Oregon. Grand juries in Oregon are very unique. They're unique when compared with the federal system, and they're unique when compared with our other states that have grand juries. I have prepared some remarks here that I would like to offer to you, and also a policy analysis from the Cato Institute that you might feel worthy of perusing. My remarks are entitled The Oregon Grand Jury, the Darling of the Prosecutor's Nursery. Oregon grand jury proceedings are conducted in secret. Hence the second page of my presentation says, instead of Brahms' lullaby, the music box plays "No One Knows What Goes On Behind Closed Doors," a song by Charlie Rich. Truth is a virtue. Truth is a virtue. The microphones that I see in this room are a testament to your belief as a body in the virtue of truth. The video recordings of what occurs here, as well as the audio counterpart, are a testament to the belief that the truth of what is said here is a virtue. What is said here is important to you, it's important to the citizens, it's important to the people that elect you and may choose to not elect you. Is the truth is important to you as you engage in political debate, if you get involved in a campaign. What your words are when you are when your positions are attacked by your opponents are incredibly important to you, and they should never ever be mischaracterized. Truth is a virtue to you, as it should be. Truth matters to the court. In Oregon, in virtually every court except a few municipal and justice courts, the courts are courts of record. Even when they are not courts of record, lawyers frequently bring court reporters into the proceeding and have the matters reported. Alternatively, sometimes there is recordation by tape recorders with the permission of the court. Truth is important in the courts because people can lose their fortunes, their liberty, and even their life based upon what is said. A witness may mistakenly or maliciously make accusations that are not true. A verbatim record of what is said in court is required by the laws that you have passed, and you pass them wisely. The truth is a friend to those who seek justice, to the judicial system, as well as to the legislative process. Truth is a virtue. The truth of what is said before grand juries throughout the United States, except for Oregon and New Hampshire, is important. Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 6E provides that except while the grand jury is deliberating or voting, all proceedings must be recorded by a court reporter or by a suitable recording device. The truth of what is said is important to other grand juries throughout the United States of America, except for Oregon and New Hampshire. I have not found any other state that does not require a verbatim record of grand jury proceedings. The truth of what is said before a grand jury is incredibly important. What is said before a grand jury can lead to an indictment of a citizen for the commission of a felony. And you have entrusted to prosecutors the discretion of when to obtain a verbatim record of what is said to a grand jury. There is a tool already on these books that you have passed, OS 132-0902, that provides a prosecutor may file a motion with the court to appoint a reporter to take and report the testimony of witnesses given before the grand jury. We wouldn't be here if those tools had been used properly by prosecutors throughout the last 15 to 20 years. We would not be here today if there had not been abuse by the prosecution of the grand jury system that permits them to take these proceedings into the secrecy of the grand jury room without a record being made of what has occurred. Sometimes, this was back in the 70s, sometimes a defendant would say, "I want to testify before the grand jury." Probably one of the silliest things that a citizen that's a suspect can do, but sometimes a truly innocent person wants to do that. And what would happen was that the prosecution would fire up the court reporter for the testimony of the defendant and the defendant alone. And all the witnesses, police witnesses, citizen witnesses, their testimony would not be taken. And finally, this got to the Supreme Court of Oregon in 1979. In this case of State Exrel Smith versus Murchison, the Supreme Court of Oregon said that if a suspect files a motion under that statute that I've just referenced to you to have the grand jury proceedings reported, the court cannot allow the motion. Only the district attorney gets to do it. It's a fair reading of the statute. But if the suspect testifies and the prosecutor files a motion for recordation, in the State XRL Drew versus Steinbach case, the court said that all of the testimony must be recorded. In other words, the prosecution may not just cherry pick the defendant's testimony out and ignore the police and citizen witnesses' testimony. If you're going to record it, you record it all. What was the reasoning of the prosecutor in that particular case? This provides the insight that illuminates the motivation between by the prosecutorial resistance to recordation. This is the key. Here's the quote from note one in that Steinbach case. In this case, it appears that at the hearing on the relators, that was the suspect's original motion for an order to record the testimony of all witnesses who appeared before the grand jury, the prosecuting attorney stated that he intended to call both civilian and police witnesses and did not intend to record their testimony, but if the relator, the suspect, asked to appear before the grand jury, he would allow the suspect to do so only on the condition that the suspect's testimony be recorded for possible impeachment purposes on trial, but that in such an event he would not record the testimony of other witnesses before the grand jury. That's the reason. That's the reason. The prosecution wants a verbatim record of what the suspect says so that they can go after him and impeach him. But they do not want to have the defense to have equal access to evidence to impeach police or civilian witnesses who were testified before the grand jury. That's why we're here today. Prosecutors want to use the truth to trap and convict people that they make into criminal defendants. Prosecutors do not want to record the truth so that the defense can trap state's witnesses with the truth of their prior statements before the grand jury. Prosecutors want to use this tool to convict and want to deprive the defense of the use of the tool to acquit. That sort of justice is spelled just us. Over the years, there has been a boxing match, literally a boxing match, between the courts and prosecutors. Each judicial punch has been responded to by a prosecutorial bob or weave. In the Steinbach case, the court said, record all the testimony or none of it. In response, here's what happened in Multnomah County where the Steinbach decision came. How are we going to get around this? How are we going to get around this? In the State versus Dickerson case, rather than have all the proceedings reported, the prosecutor's office invited an assistant attorney general to come listen to what the defendant said. And then when there was an inconsistency, the prosecutor called the assistant attorney general to testify as to the inconsistency. So the bottom line here is that there is in place a mechanism for the prosecutor to get indirectly what they could not get directly as a result of the grand jury decision in State X Rel Drew versus Steinbach. In the Carruthers case, the court said that in order to convict somebody of perjury, it's permissible to call the clerk of the grand jury to testify against the citizen, the defendant. But in Goldsby, the Court of Appeals has said that the defendant has no rights to discover the minutes taken by the clerk of the grand jury to seek to acquit. So we have a heads I win, tails you lose situation that's come down from the courts that has been embraced by the prosecution. But here's the knockout punch in this boxing match. It's often said that the prosecutors can indict a ham sandwich. The truth is even more chilling. The truth is more chilling than that. An Oregon prosecutor obtained an indictment of two police officers in Astoria, Oregon, Clatsop County, on the basis of no evidence. I repeat, on the basis of no evidence. Not a single solitary live witness, not a single affidavit, and not a single exhibit. How in the world could such a tragedy occur? The reason that such a tragedy could occur is because of the rule of secrecy and no recording. The grand jury, this is reading from the decision of the Supreme Court taking away the license of the prosecutor to practice law in this state. These are the words of the Supreme Court. The grand jury heard no evidence regarding those allegations. However, the only information that the grand jury received came from the accused. And she went on and said that these police officers had committed narcotics crimes. They got indicted on the basis of no evidence. That's a tragedy, it's a shame and a disgrace, and it should never have occurred. And the reason that it occurred is because the prosecution in that case was able to operate off the record and in secret. Imagine a circumstance where in this particular body, you all kicked all of these citizens out. And then you turned off all of the proceedings, all of the microphones. And then you heard one witness testify in favor of a bill and one witness testify against a bill. That's not the kind of lawmaking we want in this state. And I submit to you that this is not the kind of grand jury proceeding that we want to have in this state. And sometimes prosecutors use the grand juries for political cover. We all know this. Even when a police officer shoots somebody and the police have acted without any problem whatsoever, prosecutors will take the case before the grand jury, not to try to indict the police officers, but to cover up the situation so that they don't have to take political responsibility, step up to the plate and say, this police officer didn't do anything wrong. They use the grand jury as a buffer between them and the voter so that they do not have to take the heat for the decision that's ultimately made, they say, by the citizens who agree with the prosecutor that no crime was committed. But sometimes different facts get revealed after the grand jury has said no bill, no indictment of this police officer. And unfortunately, sometimes new information comes to light, and then you got a he said, she said, between a prosecutor and a citizen on the grand jury. And we have a prosecutor in this room who has unfortunately been the subject of that kind of he said, she said.
Yeah, Mr. Hanks, if you'd stick with the policy, and we are running short on time,
The best solution is to have a court reporter in there. The second best solution is to have the proceedings tape recorded. We can either do it really simply, one way, use the courtrooms themselves that have all the equipment that you've spent the taxpayers' money for, or you can get a $50 Olympus digital tape recorder, and you can plug it into a computer and download it all. It's a simple solution, and I suggest to the chair that this is the best solution that we could have right now. Thank you very much.
And we are over time, which means we've lost our committee, but I will stick here till the end.
I hope it wasn't the comments that I made.
No.
To Chair Burke, I just had to say one thing really quick. The courts have contacted us about this bill with a concern that the responsibility of the taping would be placed on the courts. We listened to them, and we've introduced amendments to LC to have the responsibility for the tape recording borne by the district attorney's office, who will be in the grand jury and can hit the play button. So those amendments have been submitted to LC.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. For the other side of the story, we have Mike Dugan and Walt Beglow. Thank you for your patience in waiting for this. Our committee members are very good about listening to tapes, so don't be too disconcerted about the fact that I'm the only one here, the only member here, counsel. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and absent members of the committee listening on tape. Thank you for having us. I'm Mike Dugan. I am the district attorney for Deschutes County. I'm a co-chair of the Oregon District Attorney's Legislative Committee, and I'm past president of the Oregon District Attorney's Association. I'm appearing here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorney's Association. I have some written testimony that I'd like to provide to the court.
Committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, the district attorneys have pointed out that this is a fiscal nightmare to require recordation of grand jury. I pointed that out in my letter. But let me address one of the things that Mr. Hingston pointed out. I can't let that go without correcting it. He pointed out that the district attorneys can indict a ham sandwich, and I then pointed to the case of Julie Lenhart, who was the district attorney in Clatsop County several years ago.
I was uncomfortable with his comments about that, and I'm kind of uncomfortable about retrying that situation here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do want to point out she was prosecuted because she committed crimes in doing that, and she was convicted and she was sentenced. We will make sure that happens any time the system is abused in such a blatant, illegal, and wrongful fashion. We have taken a survey of the District Attorney's Association with regard to this bill, Your Honor, and Madam Chair. I'm going to address you as Your Honor because that's what I'm used to doing. Excuse me.
That's fine. That's why I took this job, so people would do that.
not one district attorney that we've surveyed is in favor of this bill. As my letter points out, there are over 2,500 grand jury proceedings per month just in the survey of 25 district attorney's offices that we were able to compute this week. The recordation requirement would become a fiscal nightmare for district attorneys, the saving of those. Right now, grand jury is secret. You probably don't know that grand jury goes back over 1,000 years. It was part of English common law. It was adopted by the United States founding fathers. It was adopted by Oregon founding fathers in 1858 at Shampooey when they adopted the Constitution. And it provides three particular methods of charging a person with a felony, either grand jury, waive grand jury, go on a district attorney's information, or a preliminary hearing. Preliminary hearing being a small-scale trial, the defendant would be represented by counsel. The defendant would be able to present evidence, could testify or not. Cross-examination of witnesses. It would be a very lengthy process per case. We've got 2,500 of them. Most DAs in the state would, if grand jury is required to be recorded, would go to a preliminary hearing where that testimony is subsequently admissible as substantive evidence should the witness be unavailable. Grand jury testimony is not admissible as substantive evidence. The only reason the defense attorneys want it is to find a way to further their motion practice. You would have a situation where you would have armchair quarterbacks in every case. They would be challenging the conclusions of the grand jury. They would be arguing about the evidence or the meaning of the evidence or the process of the evidence. You would have to increase the indigent defense funding to cover the cost of the recordation copies or the transcripts. You would have to increase the indigent defense cost to cover the cost of the lawyers that have to do the motion practice. It just, the downstream effects are just great. I would be willing to answer any of your questions, Madam Chair, but suffice it to say the district attorneys are unanimously opposed to this bill. And I'm attending with Walt Biglow, who is the district attorney in Marion County.
Thank you, and I know Mr. Biglow. Did you want to add comments?
I would, Madam Chair. I am Walt Biglow. For the record, I am Marion County district attorney, and for, on behalf of the other members of the committee here, this really isn't about a boxing match. It's really about what's best for Oregon in the public safety system. I'm here to voice a clear opposition to Senate Bill 264, and I really break it down into two areas of concern. The first one is obvious, and it's the fiscal impact. And let me just give you a slice of Marion County. We average, through our grand jury, 14 cases a day, 70 cases per week, and a grand jury literally runs 9 to 4:30 5 days a week, and we have two grand juries that those folks. So you can see there's an extraordinary amount of cases that are moving through this process, and it is similar in other counties. The cost of recordation, transcripts, witness fees, whether it's going to be through grand jury or if we shifted a focus to preliminary hearing, is exorbitant. But there's also a collateral cost, and this is what I would consider a motion practice that would be inevitable in hearings related to allowing recordation and getting a hold of the transcripts related to that. And I checked with one of our prosecutors who's a former prosecutor in Arizona, where the grand jury proceedings are reported by stenographer. And her report is that there is a significant motion practice related to grand jury proceedings and alleged defects in that process. So you can imagine we're creating a separate process and what's related to that as part of the court system and indigent counsel or counsel being court appointed to represent those interests. That's very important. So it's a huge cost and that additional time in implementation. If you did this, inevitably you would slow down the process, and if you retained in your county as DA a grand jury process, it would be huge. The practical time in terms of implementation, the costs associated with law enforcement time and overtime related to that, simply the mechanics of that process, recording all the communications, which this bill contemplates, would increase incredibly what we have to do in our public safety system. For example, the orientation process here in Marion County is a separate orientation with the judge up in chambers. You would literally have to shift and make sure that that entire process was recorded up there and then shift down to the DA's office where we shepherd the cases through the process itself. And in fact, in the Arizona comments, they noted it was her recollection that orientation is also recorded, which can subject an entire jury panel's cases to litigation based on their orientation, just the conversation between the judge and the jurors to get them ramped up to do their grand jury. So there's really, with this bill, no limitation on the scope of the tape recorder following this process. In addition, we have special grand juries that the court authorizes to handle different cases, longer cases, more complex cases, cases the Department of Justice might do that will add to that particular cost. Second point is just in a practical implication. Grand jury for Oregon is a sensible process. It's seven citizens that are in panel to hear these cases. Five or more have to agree once they've heard the evidence in the case and make their decision. It's not a determination of guilt or innocence. It's about the citizens of each community deciding the initial threshold of sufficient evidence to charge or indict a felony case. The process after that, where all the rights are afforded, is the most important process of what Mr. Hinkson reflects, where able counsel is necessary to pull and do everything they can on behalf of a defendant. So recordation really does invade the traditional Oregon privacy afforded to jurors in making those decisions. It has a chilling effect on appropriate inquiries that grand jurors might ask about during the process. I'm concerned about the process of bringing children in when we have to record. They're going to be in court later during the trial. So I guess my bottom line is that the grand jurors take an oath to do grand jury. The integrity of the system is a challenge here. They're required to be fair and impartial and keep secret this process, and this bill's at odds with that. And so creating a duplication of process and expense, universally I think the district attorneys would shift towards a preliminary hearing process, in that this would undermine what we do for the citizens of Oregon every day, all day. So thank you for this opportunity to respond.
Thank you very much. Again, apologize for going over time. For the record, John Powell gave me a note saying that the Sheriff's Association shares the position of the District Attorney Association. He wasn't able to be here. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 264, and we will move the remaining items on the agenda, Senate Bill 208, Senate Bill 229, Senate Bill 234, to Tuesday's agenda. Tentatively, it's possible we may move that to Wednesday, but one of those 2 days. With that, Senate Judiciary is adjourned.